From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Mixed martial arts, once described as human cockfighting by Senator John McCain, has been flourishing lately. On the eve of the debut of the UFC in Boston, we'll trace its bloody unlikely rise in popularity, and we'll learn why some runners have turned away from traditional marathons and 10K races.
It's boring. You can't get dirty, you can't jump over fire, you can't crawl over cars in a regular race. And you can't wear shoulder pads. Duh.
Also, how some baseball teams lose everything but money, and as the World Basketball Championships get underway in Turkey, a look at two teams recently inducted into that sport's Hall of Fame. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Padres are the daddies of the NL West, it seems, and no one catches Texas now unless it's in their dreams. The Pirates, baseball's worst, are so bad that it might be funny if, despite losing almost always, they weren't making money. Joining me now on the line is Gabe Lax, who writes about baseball for USA Today. Gabe, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Very well, thank you. The documents concerning the Pirates' profits were published by Associated Press over the weekend, and in a move that you have called baseball's version of WikiLeaks, Deadspin.com released the figures from the Rays, the Angels, the Marlins, and the Mariners. Major League Baseball has responded by launching an investigation into the leak's source, and I guess that means these documents are real. Can these figures be taken at face value?
I think for the most part. I mean, the documents are definitely real. Major League Baseball and the teams affected have done nothing to suggest they aren't, aside from, you know, whatever accounting tricks may have been done. Certainly, numbers we can take pretty much for what they are.
Pirates fans have been treated to 18 consecutive losing seasons, but from 2007 through 2008, the organization posted a $29.3 million profit. The Pirates have long been recipients of baseball's revenue sharing, and this year had the lowest opening day payroll of any major league team. Should Pirates fans be upset?
In some ways, yes. It's certainly hard for teams to ever really cry poverty in this case, but I think it's also just been more a symbol of organizational ineptitude. I mean, they really have just been a victim of going back to the drawing board too many times and failing. With the Pirates, I take that more as an example of a deeper organizational ineptitude than just flat-out greed necessarily.
We're only talking about figures from five teams here. Is there any way to know if those figures from the Pirates, the Rays, the Angels, the Marlins, and the Mariners are representative?
It's about as representative as it can be. I mean, it makes sense when you look at what we do know about these teams. We do know that some markets are better than others for TV revenue, some teams do better than others at the gate, and so on and so forth. There are some things that do make you scratch your head and go, oh, that's pretty interesting, but there's really nothing in the figures that has made you go, you know, wow, that's a real shocker.
Well, tell me what has made you scratch your head and say that's pretty interesting.
Well, the fact that the Seattle Mariners lost money simply because they have been one of the better revenue-generating teams and got a pretty good sweetheart stadium deal up there in Seattle, to me, that kind of illustrated that you really have to I don't want to say try hard to lose money, because of course nobody tries hard at it, but in a way it kind of serves as a defense for some of the teams that do turn a profit, because it's a pretty good business to be in, which is why whenever a team goes on the market, there's usually a line out the door of buyers trying to get into the fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, if you do make a few missteps and you kind of, you know, as they say, go for it, and you open up the checkbook and then it, you know, blows up in your face, then it really sets you behind the eight ball, not only for that year, but, you know, perhaps for years to come.
The best headline that I've seen this week is, quote, liar, liar, fish on fire. During 2007 and 2008, the Florida Marlins, a.k.a. the Fish, made $49 million in profit while strong-arming city and county officials into paying about 75% of the costs of a $642 million stadium project. The city of Miami, of course, has recently declared a fiscal emergency. Any surprise that the Marlins said no thank you when asked to renegotiate the revenue deals for that new stadium?
You know, it's not a whole lot of surprise there. Yeah, when you get a deal like that, you certainly don't give back the ground you've gained. You know, they'll be reaping the benefits in terms of franchise value and revenue and everything else for many, many years. This on its own really isn't anything too new. It's a song and dance and tango that franchises and municipalities have been, you know, engaged in for a couple generations now. It's just that now we've found out, well, you know, they're not as poor as maybe they appeared to be.
If an organization can make a profit while fielding a losing team year after year, and they risk money if they want to try and field a winning team, what incentive is there in that context for teams like the Pirates and the Marlins to add to their payroll?
Well, that's certainly going to be the billion-dollar question going forward. It may shake up the structure of how baseball does business. You're right. You just hope they try to do the right thing, make a good effort to succeed, particularly if they've taken public money for their facilities, because nobody said, let's build the hometown ball club a team so they can stink. You know, that's never what anybody wants. So, yeah,
Not publicly, anyway.
Exactly.
Red Sox owner John Henry has long been calling for change to baseball's revenue-sharing scheme. I suppose Mr. Henry is probably not among those upset at the release of the documents this week.
You would think not, especially since it wasn't his team getting leaked. The Red Sox and the Yankees, you know, have invested in their product. That being said, they are also positioned in markets in which they're going to have an inherent advantage over so many other franchises. So is revenue sharing fair? Probably. To what extent does it need to happen to promote fairness while also not penalizing these teams for being successful? That's what they need to figure out. And now the interesting thing is, you know, I'm guessing the owners have a year here to kind of get their house in order. You know, I mean, there may be some civil strife there in the fraternity just because you're going to have your John Henrys and the Steinbrenner family and others who are going to say, okay, wait a minute, you know, the welfare years are over with, and then you're going to have the smaller markets saying we can't survive.
It would seem to me that the greatest casualty of the release of these figures would be anybody in a small market team town saying we can't survive.
Potentially. Now, one of the interesting things that came out this week were the Tampa Bay Rays, because they are in the midst of trying to get a new stadium, and it's difficult, and it's a strange market down there. But one thing that the figures did do was kind of make the case for them that, yeah, their revenues within their stadium make it extremely difficult. So, yeah, they're making money, but to really compete, you know, they're at a pretty significant disadvantage.
Gabe Lax writes about baseball for USA Today. Gabe, thanks very much for joining me.
You got it. Anytime. I appreciate it.
Today, teams representing 24 nations will play in the preliminary round of the World Basketball Championships in Turkey. The U.S. will face Croatia in Istanbul. The latest incarnation of Team USA follows the recent induction of two U.S. Olympic teams into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
The first Olympic gold medal basketball game was played in 1936 on a muddy outdoor court in Berlin. The U.S. overwhelmed Canada 19-8. A new exhibit at the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts, highlights that achievement and other historic moments for U.S. national teams. Earlier this month, the hall enshrined the U.S. teams that won gold in 1960 and 1992. Walking through the exhibit, curator Matt Zeising says the 1960 roster was stacked with talent.
Jerry Lucas and Oscar Robertson and Jerry West, three of the greatest players of all time, just happened to be able to, you know, timing and everything, get on the same Olympic team. And so you get to 1960 and you have what might have been, or probably was, the greatest amateur team ever assembled for any country.
The 1960 team's average margin of victory was more than 42 points. Oscar Robertson, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame as an individual in 1980 and is now a successful businessman, says among all of his achievements as a player, his Olympic experience stands out.
To be able to play for your country and stand on the stand and receive the gold medal, it's a very emotional experience, really. But that was a special treat for me, and there's nothing that can replace that because it happened so early in my career. Before I got into the pros, we were still amateur players. Now the things have changed altogether.
The Team USA exhibit also honors women's Olympic basketball, which debuted in 1976. The U.S. women earned their first gold medal in 1984, the year the U.S. men won their last gold as amateurs. Today, that 1984 men's roster sounds like an NBA who's who, featuring names like Michael Jordan, Patrick Ewing, and Chris Mullin. Team member John Konkak went on to an 11-year NBA career with Atlanta and Orlando. He says he and his teammates didn't realize then that 1984 represented the end of an era.
You know, none of those guys had signed pro contracts yet, and none of them had agents because we had to maintain amateur status. So nobody had a lot of money. Nobody was driving a fancy car. You know, now for a lot of those guys, it's a lot different.
Things began to change in 1988.
The world has certainly caught up with the United States in this game. No longer does the U.S. dominate as they did for so much of these Olympic Games.
Dick Enberg made that comment on NBC as the U.S. was about to lose to the Soviet Union in a semifinal game in Seoul, South Korea. The U.S. collegiate players would bring home bronze, the country's worst Olympic finish in basketball. Olympic rules had prohibited NBA players from appearing in the games, but the following year, the International Amateur Basketball Federation, or FIBA, voted to change that, setting the stage for the 1992 Dream Team. Hall of Fame curator Matt Zeisen.
It was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones all mixed into one. And it wasn't just that it was Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan. It was also the fact that in 1972 or 1952, because of where the world was, they just wouldn't have been known the way they were. So thanks to mass media and a culture that could accept this, they were international icons, international superstars.
Opponents posed for pictures with U.S. players and asked for autographs. The team won its games by more than 43 points on average. Hall of Fame player and coach Lenny Wilkins was an assistant coach for the Dream Team. Today he runs a charitable foundation and works as a basketball consultant. Wilkins says the 1992 roster was so strong they never designated a starting five.
We would start a different team every game, and then at the end of the game let the guys who are playing well play. The players bought into it. It probably overwhelmed a lot of people, but I think that it's a big reason why basketball around the world really picked up.
While every gold medal victory sparks new debate about the greatest U.S. teams of all time, most observers agree that 1960 and 1992 stand out. Who would win in a head-to-head matchup? Oscar Robertson admits he's biased.
I think we would have won. I'm sure the 92 team thought they would have won. But that's what you should think.
The current U.S. team, playing in the World Championship in Turkey, features a blend of NBA veterans like Chauncey Billups and Lamar Odom, and up-and-coming players like Kevin Durant and Derrick Rose. And it's probably safe to say, if they reach the championship game on September 12th and win, they'll like their chances against the teams of the past, too. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Northern Montana, land of glaciers, trout streams, cowboy hats, and pig wrestling. Or at least it's supposed to be. The annual pig wrestling competition, scheduled for the country fair in Great Falls this summer, has been canceled because nobody can find the pigs. These pigs, without whom pig wrestling would be essentially pointless, spend the year on a range along the Marias River, and each year at this time, 30 of them are supposed to be captured. This year, only one has been located. Not enough for much wrestling, but the organizers of the competition know the porkers are out there somewhere and hope to find them by next August. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, how to dress for competitive fire leaping. But first, over the past 6 years, the UFC has gone from the edge of bankruptcy to a billion-dollar enterprise. Once banned in 36 states, mixed martial arts competitions are now sanctioned in 44 U.S. states, and they sell out venues from Paris to Abu Dhabi. Joining me on the line is Ron Borges, who writes for the Boston Herald. Ron, welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be here, Bill.
Let's start with the money. 6 years ago, UFC president Dana White and owners Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta were deep in the hole. They couldn't get their sport on pay-per-view TV. They were having trouble finding states that would sanction competitions. How did they turn it around?
Well, they had a good business model, a good concept, and they also began to realize they were going to have to negotiate with the regulators in various states. And at the same time, push the fact that the rules had been changed a few years earlier and it wasn't quite the no rules fighting. But the key thing for them was when they created a reality television show that they got on Spike TV, and that was where their sport really took off.
Ron, I know the answer because I read your article this week, but our listeners may not know how much Spike TV paid this organization for the first televised mixed martial arts production.
Spike TV paid them zero, and they paid Spike TV $10 million to produce the show. They were already $34 million in losses in a span of 4 years. And so they were about ready to pull the plug on the whole sport, the Fertitta brothers, who are casino owners in Vegas. And then they decided, we'll take one last shot. We'll see if we can get a reality show on TV. And they did. And the last of that first show got a 1.9 rating, and their next pay-per-view show did 300,000 buys, which was twice as much as they'd ever done before. So they owe a lot to Spike TV, and Spike TV now has to pay to get them on there.
By April of 2008, Forbes magazine had declared that the UFC really should be called the UCM for Ultimate Cash Machine. What is it that's made this sport so profitable?
Well, I think their marketing has been incredible, and their grasp on social media and all the sort of new forms of media. And I also think it's a generational thing. You know, they really sold it as, you know, boxing was your grandfather's sport. Mixed martial arts is your generation's sport. And it's, in many ways, Bill, a sort of glorified video game. You know, there's pounding music, there's lights flashing, there's very fast action, and then boom, they're off to the next fight. And in this day and age, it appears with many people have the attention span of a fruit fly, so this is perfect for them. They don't want to wait to watch Sugar Ray Leonard set anybody up for a knockout.
Tonight's event at the Boston Garden, home of the Bruins and the Celtics, has the potential to break that venue's all-time revenue record. Actually, the record was set by Barbara Streisand in 2006. But how much money are we talking about here?
You know, if they sell it out, I mean, you're talking about seven figures in climbing. You know, there was a time when they got 500 people. They were dancing in the streets. But in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, their pay-per-view shows have gone through the roof. They sell out most arenas around the country. And, of course, they had a hard time getting into Boston. This is the first time they've ever been here. And I think you have the combination of their natural constituency and people who might just say, well, maybe this is interesting, or, you know, my son's into it or my son's friends are into it. Maybe I should go take a look. So I think they have a very good chance of selling out the Garden, which hasn't been done for anything other than basketball in a long time.
Late last year, Massachusetts became the 42nd state to sanction mixed martial arts. What convinced Massachusetts and all but six other U.S. states to reject John McCain's contention some years ago that this is basically human cockfighting?
Well, you know how it is in sports, Bill. It's all about the money. They saw those tremendous attendance numbers and the tax dollars that are connected with them in a lot of other states. And they saw the big pay-per-view numbers, and I think they really felt they couldn't hold them off anymore. New York State is one of the few sort of remaining holdouts. The other thing is, Bill, is that they did a very smart thing about 4 years ago. They hired a guy named Mark Ratner, who had been the executive director of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, primarily in charge of boxing. And he was well-respected, government regulator, was known in all parts of the country. And they hired him on, and that, from a regulator standpoint, really made a lot of guys look up and say, you know, Ratner's a legitimate guy. Maybe this thing he's involved with is a legitimate enterprise. And he's really had a lot of influence on a lot of these various governments, including here in Massachusetts.
Mark Ratner has said that his job is to fight against the misconception that MMA is a bloody, no-holds-barred sport. But it is bloody, and except for eye gouging, it's pretty close to no-holds-barred. Are we really just talking about semantics here?
Well, they don't let you kick a guy in the head when he's on the ground anymore, so that's a major step forward.
And that's no fun. Why would anybody buy a ticket?
Exactly, and you can't punch in the groin anymore, which is a good thing. You know, I mean, there has been a lot of change. And I will say this, you know, unlike football and unlike boxing and unlike motorsports,
They've never had a fatality, and their injuries are, believe it or not, more on the surface than in other sports, certainly in boxing, because they have one thing unique to their sport, which is they have sanctioned quitting. You can, what they call, tap out. You can't tap out boxing. You're there until somebody else rescues you. But in their sport, if you're choking to death, you know, or you feel don't want to go on any longer, you can tap, and the referee jumps in, and that's the end of it. So that's their form of law and order.
I do remember a well-known fight in which a gentleman named Duran said, no mas. That's sort of the boxing equivalent of tapping out, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And he, you know, it'll be in his obituary. He's never been forgiven for that. Whereas in MMA, you can't continue, no problem. They just go on and no one's upset about it.
Ron, just last week it was announced that the province of Ontario, Canada, would finally sanction MMA. But then this week, the Canadian Medical Association called for a ban on mixed martial arts competitions in Canada. Who's going to win here, money or medical professionals?
You don't even have to ask the question, do you?
You know, I have to. It's my job. But you answer it.
Money. It's, you know, in this, especially in this day and age where the economy's all and state governments and federal governments all in economic trouble, money's going to triumph. They can deliver big crowds, which means big tax revenue. And as Mayor Menino talked about, he's not going to go to the show himself because he finds it appalling, but he's happy to see all these people coming to Boston to go to see the show. So in the end, money usually triumphs.
Ron Borges writes for the Boston Herald. Ron, thanks very much for joining me.
Sure. Glad to do it, Bill.
Anybody who's been through boot camp would probably wonder why a sane person would choose to run a 3-mile obstacle course complete with walls to scale, flames to leap, barbed wire to crawl under, and a sea of mud. But that's exactly why almost 10,000 weekend warriors have invaded Copper Mountain, Colorado this Saturday and Sunday at the Rocky Mountain Warrior Dash. Only a Game's Kim Green scouted the Southeast Warrior Dash earlier this year and offers this intel from a muddy patch of earth in Mountain City, Georgia.
Everyone gets everything he wants. I wanted a race, and for my sins, they gave me one. At the starting gate, a host of warriors 500 strong musters beneath the unblinking eye of a relentless southern sun. A raiding party from the wilds of Tallahassee braces for the struggle ahead. These young braves are, as yet, untested.
No, I've never done anything like this before. Never been in the loincloth before either. It's a new, it's a first.
Political correctness lies slain on this battlefield. These irregulars parody, or perhaps pay tribute to, all manner of bygone heroes. Horned Vikings, red-caped Spartans, kilted Highlanders, and a legion of sexy Norse goddesses bedecked with faux fur and ersatz blonde braids. For these warriors, the hostilities began weeks or months ago in craft stores across America.
Our outfits took a lot of effort. They're just as close as we could get to real Indian costumes by going to Michael's and getting some t-shirts and making some loincloths and a lot of beads and a lot of feathers.
3 minutes away!
The natives grow restless as our motley host prepares to assault the terrain ahead. I'm nervous. Did Henry V get butterflies at Agincourt? Did his band of brothers fret about their outfits?
I'm afraid we're going to catch on fire when we jump over. Just get our loincloths and the dresses are just going to go up in flames.
I hope we catch on fire. Lots and lots of fire.
I love the smell of burning feathers in the morning. It smells like victory. And we're off. A ragtag battalion marching en masse past a starting gate that shoots out plumes of fire every few seconds. Half a league onward.
Here we go! Yeah!
The Southeast Warrior Dash snakes 3.2 miles through the rolling and rural Appalachian northeast corner of Georgia. More than 13,000 bizarrely clad belligerents have occupied the unsuspecting little town of Mountain City. The locals seem to be taking it all in stride. I jog past a sign on somebody's front porch that says, "Keep running. I hear banjos."
Penalty!
I set my sights on my husband Hal's gold sequin skirt up ahead, among the more sedate costumes on hand today. But it won't glitter for long. We round a corner and engage the first obstacle, a shallow, muddy lake.
Thank you.
And then a slick morass of muck-filled tires. Forget high-stepping it through these. I fall three times. This is not my finest hour. For the next half hour, we run a gauntlet of obstacles, conceived by some diabolical arch-criminal mind. Barricades of rusted-out cars, a cargo net wall, and the coup de grace. A mudslide into a gummy quagmire of viscous ooze with barbed wire overhead. The horror.
Oh my God, I'm stuck! Whose idea was this? Just leave your shoe, you don't need it!
For the finale, the battle reaches a fever pitch. Another small lake to cross, and then we draw heavy fire. Of sorts. Megan from Woodstock, Georgia, can't get the images out of her mind.
Yeah, you're just coming out of the lake, and they've got it's about 10 feet long, just, you know, logs of fire and jumping over it, and it seemed like it was at least a foot and a half high, and I was like, are my legs that long, and am I going to get burned, you know? So it was scary. It was scary. I was afraid my shorts were going to catch on fire.
She's 6 foot, and she's wondering if her legs are long enough. Figure that one out.
Amidst this unclean horde, we stagger across the finish line onto a vast plain of assorted soldiery. There are two kinds of people here. Squeaky clean, jittery greenhorns suiting up, and exhilarated, mud-encrusted veterans gnawing Valhalla-sized turkey legs and swilling beer from tankards. Or whatever vessel these barbarians can find.
I am drinking my beer out of a boot.
Yes!
Out of a boot.
Like a lot of the Warrior Dash rank and file, Jim and Matt from Virginia have not taken the warrior theme too literally. They seem to be single-handedly fighting some kind of culture war.
It's an awesome wig with a hairband. I did have a blue muscle shirt on, like from the 80s, and now I'm half naked. I'm going for a flock of seagulls meets Menudo.
Lots of folks have adopted this sort of fusion approach to interpreting the warrior concept, or they've just rejected it altogether. There's a male wedding party decked out in matching bridesmaid frocks, a troop in tutus, and for some reason, there's even a guy dressed as Jesus. Please tell me this is an Armageddon. Although the fashion statements are by no means uniform, these battle-weary comrades in arms do have one thing to unite them. War stories.
The most fun was doing a Dukes of Hazzard over the wrecked cars in the forest. It was like a junkyard in nature. I did an ass plant on the hood of one of them. So I'm probably going to be bruised later in my special place.
Tis but a scratch. He won't be getting a Purple Heart, but everybody who finishes goes home with a medal and a fuzzy warrior helmet festooned with foam horns. And although a few Special Forces types actually trained for this event, the majority of us here are everyday weekend warriors looking for the kind of adventure an ordinary road race can't deliver. A guy wearing football shoulder gear with styrofoam cones glued all over it introduces himself as Hulk the Road Warrior. He's got an axe to grind with your run-of-the-mill 5K.
It's boring. You can't get dirty, you can't jump over fire, you can't crawl over cars in a regular race. And you can't wear shoulder pads. Duh.
For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Mountain City, Georgia, and I shall return.
You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, Charlie Pierce read a poetic farewell to basketball written by retiring NBA player Adonal Foyle. Charlie occasionally interrupted that reading with editorial comments, as did I. This dismayed Lillian Restaino-Bauman, who listens to the program on WLRN in Miami. She emailed as follows, "I could not believe that Charlie, the same intellect who made me a diehard fan when he described Bush as the Avignon president, became, along with you, Bill, a nasty pre-adolescent boy, subjecting the less sophisticated outsider to puerile ridicule as you read Adonal Foyle's attempt at poetry. This behavior was so beneath the two of you. Dear God, my heroes have clay feet. June Gogi, among other listeners, felt otherwise. As a high school English teacher, I would be grateful if you would provide me with a copy of O'Donnell Foyle's poem, she wrote. May William Butler Yeats rest in peace. It would be especially lovely if you could include your astute editorial musings. I'm not exactly sure how I will fold this poem into the curriculum, but trust me, I will. Perhaps the day after basketball tryouts would be a good time. The upcoming indictment of Roger Clemens on perjury charges came up in last week's program, and Alan Knight, who hears the program on WOSU in Ohio, emailed a comment on same. The whole piece went on as if it was obvious Clemens was guilty of taking illegal performance-enhancing drugs, he wrote. He only perjured himself if he did take the PEDs, which he claims he didn't. Isn't a presumption of innocence in order here? In our salute to Bobby Thompson, the former New York Giant who died last week, Charlie agreed with me that the home run with which Thompson beat the Dodgers for the 1951 pennant was as famous as any. Greg Carney, another Miami listener, feels we unfairly neglected to consider one other home run. I know it was only for a small market franchise that has long since fallen into ignominy, but I would like to put in a mention of the home run Bill Mazeroski hit in the bottom of the ninth inning of the seventh game of the World Series in 1960. It seemed just as dramatic as Bobby Thompson's shot. Maz just didn't play for a New York team. You can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our always entertaining and constantly changing website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This week, Ludwig Fichte, a 29-year-old German skydiver, launched himself from an airplane in a rubber dinghy and began plummeting toward the Earth, which was approximately 14,000 feet below him. By the time he'd fallen about 8,000 feet in just over 30 seconds, Mr. Fichte had solved the Rubik's Cube he was carrying. Safe and sound on the ground, Mr. Fichte said, "Solving the Rubik's Cube in free fall has been done before by three people, but I am the first to do it in a rubber boat." So who can doubt that Mr. Fichte's next plan will involve solving two cubes while sitting in a cement boat and eating beach glass as the guys back in the plane throw power tools at him? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a look at the history of segregation in Southern college sports with the author of Benching, Jim Crow. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It's almost September, and you have before you the current Major League Baseball standings. Texas would appear to be a lock, likewise San Diego. Who else makes the postseason?
Well, I mean, right now, it looks like I'm going to be, if you want to follow pennant races, you follow them in the National League. The only close one in the American League is New York and Tampa Bay, and they're just deciding who's going to win the division and who's not. They're both going to make the playoffs. I guess I would watch Atlanta and Philadelphia. It's going to be very interesting to see if Philadelphia can muster up another run.
Highly touted rookie Steven Strasburg has pitched well for the Washington Nationals when he's been able to pitch, which is not often enough. Yesterday, the Nationals announced their star will probably require Tommy John reconstructive surgery, in which case he'd be out for 12 to 18 months. My guess is Mr. Strasburg's wince on the mound last Saturday night was felt all the way to the commissioner's office.
Well, I can imagine, but I mean, I have to tell you, Bill, we said this before they moved him there. God does not want a baseball team in Washington. If they'd moved the Expos to Havana the way I recommended, Strasburg would still be healthy and Castro would have fallen by now. Mm-hmm. They don't listen to me, Bill.
Johnny Damon, late of the Yankees, and before that, the Red Sox passed on the opportunity to return to Boston after the Sox claimed him on waivers this week. He said he's staying with the Tigers in part because, quote, these guys really like me. One wonders why they put him on waivers, if that's the
well,
case.
Well, apparently he's not worried about the front office, but because, God love him, he individually spoke to each of his teammates, making sure that they liked him. Mm-hmm. They really liked him. Yeah. So the teammates like him.
Yeah, and a couple of Red Sox called and said, we really like you, too. Do you suppose there was more to Johnny's decision not to come back to Boston?
Yeah, I think the reception he got when he came back with the Yankees and the fact that he has maintained for years that the Red Sox essentially called him a liar during the negotiations, not believing the Yankees had offered him what the Yankees had offered him, probably played more into this.
In a couple of weeks, we will reach the 25th anniversary of the day upon which Pete Rose set baseball's hit record, Charlie. The Cincinnati Reds contacted Rose about commemorating that event at the ballpark. How'd that work out for him?
You know what? You know what? He can't because he has a prior commitment. Where's his prior commitment, Bill? Wait for it. In a casino! Isn't that sort of a constant prior commitment in his life? Is there a day in the calendar year in which Pete Rose doesn't have a prior commitment in a casino?
No, the only question is, when the Reds called him, did he say, I bet you can't guess why I can't be there.
Exactly right.
During his tenure as head of Major League Baseball's Players Association, Don Fehr presided over three work stoppages and the cancellation of the 1994 World Series. Is that what convinced the players in the National Hockey League to turn to him for leadership?
Well, I think the fact that he was able to stand up baseball management and knock it down like bowling pins is probably what the NHLPA is looking for. This has been a union full of sheep for about 50 years, and if any union in sports has needed Don Fehr, it's these guys.
The NFL owners met this week and collectively salivated over the possibility of adding two games to the regular season. The owners of the Jets and the Giants might be especially inclined to support that proposal, or do their bottom lines suggest that it might be better to add, 10 games?
Yeah, both of them are extraordinarily debt-ridden, if you believe the official accountings that they do, which is probably not a smart idea at any point. Two more opportunities to demolish your brain does not strike me as a wise idea. I think the Players Association will fight this one tooth and nail going into the negotiations for the new CBA.
Fans of the Baltimore Ravens will be happy to learn that the team has a new fight song, Charlie, and if you're old enough, I guess you find it familiar.
Yeah, they have apparently adapted the old Baltimore Colts fight song to now the first line reads, Baltimore Ravens, let's go. Let me be the first one to predict that this will occasion great torrents of anger in Baltimore, or at the very least in Cleveland, or in Indianapolis, or someplace where one of those teams is now.
Yeah, because there's still a Baltimore Colts fan club in Baltimore. You know, they never dispersed.
And the people, I guarantee you, there'll be dozens of showing of the movie Diner all over Baltimore during the season, if there isn't already.
Charlie, the young people with whom I work celebrate tweeting as a free and convenient way to keep in touch with everybody. Chad Ochocinco would perhaps not agree with the free part after this week's accounting.
Yeah, $25,000 fine for two violation of the league's anti-tweeting policy.
Can't tweet during a game.
No, you got up 90 minutes until before kickoff and until the post-game media obligations are fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
So the NFL, you know, living up to the No Fun League acronym that people have hung on it, are not going to let Chad, like, tweet during the middle of a pattern like, I'm rarely open! Get me the ball!
I love that.
That's right.
That's great. As
quarterback
long as
with a little BlackBerry on his
you
sleeve
have
here.
Have it right there.
Absolutely.
When the police discover you naked and drunk early in the morning,
they never have.
Where you don't belong,
they never have.
There are a lot of things. There are a lot of things that you can do. Apparently, even if you're a college football player, dropping into a three-point stance and lunging at the officers is not your best option.
This is an Oregon State offensive lineman. We won't use his name because someday he will have children and they don't need to know about this. He got dismissed from the team after this particular escapade. Of course, the two police had to use their stun guns because they couldn't get out of the way of a drunken, naked lineman who was lunging at them.
Are you surprised that his coach didn't at least ask to see film to see if it was a good block?
I'm fairly sure it probably wasn't.
On Monday, Rajon Rondo made coach Mike Krzyzewski's life easier by deciding that he didn't really want to play in basketball's world championships after all, or at least that is Mr. Rondo's story. Does that seem likely?
I suspect he felt that he probably wasn't going to make the team. His difficulties with the jump shot have come back to haunt him, which is more of a problem in international ball than in the NBA.
This is the time of year when we hear about football players fighting with their teammates, and often coaches take these tussles as a good sign that their players are game ready, but not Northwestern coach Pat Fitzgerald. Do you approve the way he handled the contretemps at practice this week?
I want him hired at every university. But first of all, I think he's probably most upset by the fact that the fight devolved into two guys swinging their helmets at each other, which is the football equivalent of hitting someone with your purse. So he said to them, "You guys are idiots." Then he made them walk a lap holding hands, which is not only humiliating, but really charming.
And finally, Charlie, the Japan Sumo Association has yet another excuse for the gambling scandal that has rocked the sport. The association says that it's been difficult to communicate with the athletes because their fingers are too fat for modern cell phones. What, pray tell, is the association's solution to this problem?
The solution to the problem of fat-fingered sumo wrestlers? They get really big iPads. Between this and my proposal to allow Chad Ocherenko to tweet during the game, I think we've reached entirely new levels of modern cybersports.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, not, I presume, on an iPad, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
I'm open, you moron!
iPad, 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 iPad,
nerds are gonna hate because they don't like the specs, but the specs aren't the point at all. It's all about the App Store and iTunes, the convenient distribution of software and
. 15 years after Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and 13 years after the NBA was finally integrated, and 45 years after an NFL team first signed a black player, nearly all the major college teams in all sports in the South were still entirely white. In Benching Jim Crow, Charles Martin, an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at El Paso, explores the history of segregation in college athletics in the South. He joins me now from KTEP in El Paso. Professor Martin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
In 1966, Texas El Paso, then known as Texas Western University, became the first team to start five black players and win a national championship. They beat an all-white University of Kentucky team to do that. Is it coincidence that the author of Benching Jim Crow teaches at Texas El Paso?
No, it's not any coincidence at all. In fact, the reason I got started thinking about this larger project came from the 20th reunion of that team on our campus in 1986, and I was there and I did a couple of interviews for our Oral History Institute. Eventually, when I finished another project, I did finally get to it.
Early in the book, you write about a gentleman's agreement by which black athletes at northern schools were held out of games against southern teams. Who were the gentlemen involved, and what provoked them to come to this agreement?
Well, the gentlemen involved would have been the coaches and administrators of the southern teams and also the northern teams. It basically said that whenever a northern team plays a team from the south, and these would be from historically white colleges and universities, they will voluntarily withhold any African-American players so as not to embarrass or inconvenience their southern guests if the game is in the north, or when they go to the south, they certainly would not impose. So the idea is that you would be a gracious host and a gracious visitor and basically sell out any African-American players on your teams in order to avoid offending the white southerners' view of proper racial etiquette.
Boston College was one of the schools that abided by that so-called gentleman's agreement. You write that the school never considered declining the invitation to play in the 1940 Cotton Bowl and agreed to leave Lou Montgomery, a black player who had starred for BC, at home. By the 1940 Cotton Bowl, Mr. Montgomery must have been used to this sort of treatment since BC had benched him six times for games against southern teams. Was Boston College representative?
Boston College represented a more extreme case than the typical northern team. Generally, there weren't that many intersectional games back then. So usually each school would have one big game, one big intersectional game for profits and prestige every year. Boston College was a little bit different because they were an upstart. They were trying to build a reputation, and the major powers in the Northeast wouldn't play them. It was below them to play lowly Boston College. So Boston College scheduled two regular season games in each of Montgomery's junior and senior years to build up publicity about the team. And then because they did so well, they had the opportunity to play in two postseason bowl games, all of which, except for the Rose Bowl, were located in the South and had to then follow Southern rules.
Mm-hmm. In some states, the segregation that we've talked about was formally established. In 1956, Louisiana passed a law making it illegal to sponsor an integrated athletic event. How common was that sort of legislation?
Louisiana was unusual in that they actually formally drafted a law. Georgia also attempted to, but it was narrowly blocked through some legislative maneuvering. But occasionally they would simply be informal policies, but there would be state and local segregation ordinances requiring segregation of facilities, bathrooms, etc. And sometimes those segregation laws were interpreted as banning actual competition on the playing field as well. It was sort of implied in those kinds of laws.
Lots of universities in the South fielded all-white football and basketball teams through most of the 60s, as you say. Besides the civil rights laws, what motivated college presidents, athletic directors, and coaches to finally begin changing that circumstance?
When Northern teams began not to cooperate after World War II in the gentlemen's agreement, at least for games in the North, this meant then that you were a competitive disadvantage as an Alabama or a Mississippi State or a Florida when you went to play an intersectional game, because if there were black players on these other teams, you always had to play outside the South. So the desire to be a full-fledged member of national collegiate sporting culture, the desire to be seen as a major university, which meant having a big-time football and basketball team, and the pragmatic benefits eventually then that come from this competition and eventually from recruiting black players for your own teams, eventually won out over the desire to preserve racial segregation, especially after laws and federal courts prohibited the kind of exclusion that had been traditional in the South.
Perhaps one of the most surprising stories in Benching Jim Crow is the story with which you have chosen to begin the introduction to your book. It involves Wade Houston, the first black basketball coach ever hired by the University of Tennessee in 1989. Tell us about what happened when Coach Houston tried to take advantage of one of the perks enjoyed by all the other UT head coaches.
Well, I use that example because I think it shows both change and also continuity concerning racial issues in the South. Wade Houston was from Alcoa, Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville, but he was not able to play basketball when he graduated from high school in the early 60s at the University of Tennessee because their athletic programs were all white. So he went on to play at Louisville and later coached at Louisville. Then, many years later, he's invited back to become the first black coach in any major sport at Tennessee and the first black basketball coach in the Southeastern Conference. And he goes back and he's greeted very warmly. But within 2 weeks after he has arrived there and accepted the position, the newspapers now report that he has been denied membership in the Cherokee Country Club, which was the country club where university officials maintained their memberships. Now, he discreetly said that he was too busy recruiting to worry about playing golf. And obviously, University of Tennessee officials should have known that this country club was segregated. But it didn't really seem to matter much until they had a black fellow coach, and then suddenly it mattered a lot.
Regarding inclusion in the university, how does the landscape of major college sports strike you today?
Well, things have changed somewhat since my book ended in 1980. After that era of integration ends, people become more aware that it's not just who the players are or even who the coaches are, but who's the athletic director, what kind of an education are the players getting. So things have changed dramatically, but I would not suggest that all racial issues have been solved. Nonetheless, integrated athletic programs in the South stand out as being one of the most integrated activities in Southern society. And given the way that Southerners and really most Americans value athletic programs, it's very important to see integrated teams that include blacks, whites, and other groups today working together for a common cause.
Charles Martin is the author of Benching Jim Crow, The Rise and Fall of the Color Line in Southern College Sports, 1890 to 1980. The book is published by Illinois University Press. And Professor Martin joined me from KTEP in El Paso. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jack Flagler. We had help this week from Dennis Wu at KTEP in El Paso, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see Kim Green's Warrior Dash photos, read my review of Benching Jim Crow, or revisit stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. In our final word, Oscar Robertson dreams of further improving Team USA 1960's chances of winning a fantasy match against 1992's Dream Team.
Now, I'll say this. What if he had put Russell and Chamberlain on the team? Then I don't think they would have won a game.
Hey, put Russell and Chamberlain on my team, I wouldn't lose a game either. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. This is NPR.